Welcome to the Leadership Trap Podcast, recording live from Austin, Texas. In this podcast, we explore the conditions that lead to surviving and thriving in a successful leadership role. We examine the traps that can cause leaders to stumble, bumble, or get ambushed in ways that may or may not be of their own making. I'm Dr. Chris Petrovka, and with David Hewen of Austin WorkNet, we have a conversation with each leader that explores the traps they've encountered throughout their leadership journey. Hopefully, it brings a new perspective to your role as a leader and helps you navigate your own way through the traps. Thanks for joining us. Let's jump into the trap. Welcome to the Leadership Trap. This is Chris Petrovka, and I'm here with my co-host, David Hewen of Austin WorkNet. And today's guest, David Altunian, founder and CEO of Motion Computing, former Dell and Motorola executive, and currently Associate Dean and MBA Program Director at the Bill Munday School of Business at St. Edward's University, and a partner at the Capital Factory. But there's more. Over 30 years of marketing and management experience in the tech industry, and he's done more than just do. He's actually pretty smart. He's got a PhD with a focus in entrepreneurship. Basically, a really smart guy who's helped a lot of leaders build their businesses. So David, enough of me in the intro, though. Why mess around? Let's jump straight into the first trap.
Thanks, Chris. David, welcome. I'm especially curious in your, I guess, not so new. How long have you been doing the academic stint now?
This is my 12th year.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, remember I started as an adjunct professor when I was at Motion Computing.
Okay.
Just as an accident. So I had 5 years of doing adjuncting, and then this is starting my 7th year as a full-time faculty member.
So I'm curious to know if you've gotten it down to the point where whenever you have an incoming class, is there one primary message that you deliver to your new students that is a don't fall into this trap message as a future leader? Is there anything you put at the top of the list that they need to know early on that prevents them from making the same mistake you did?
I think probably the biggest thing that I try to share with my students is not to over-focus on the result and the activity, and try to think about what you're supposed to be learning. And even if you don't get it from the materials that are directly being given to you by me in class, go do the research, try to understand what the nature is of what we're trying to teach. And actually, I learned that early on. You know, one of the problems we have in K through 12 is that we teach students to memorize and repeat. And students get over-focused on, you know, is this the right font? Am I using the right, you know, citation format? Am I answering the question exactly the way my professor or my teacher expects me to learn? And the problem is that carries through to academia. And as we've seen in the workforce, it carries through in the workforce, where people spend more time trying to make sure they're answering the question exactly the way they think the boss asked it to get their grade versus what's the question you're really being asked. So I really focus my students early on, you know, don't get freaked out about your grade. Don't get freaked out if you don't understand. Do some effort to research and understand on your own, and then come back to me for clarification. Don't focus on, you know, are you guessing what me as your teacher or your boss is trying to get you to understand? And then I think that's a crossover lesson I learned from business, because, you know, we've seen so many people that spend more time trying to just get the assignment done right and don't really understand what the assignment really is.
And then, David, because you've been in Austin for quite some time, right? And this is
right.
Yeah, you're Austin.
Since 94, I moved to Austin 94 for Dell. But even before that, I was at Compaq in the late 80s. And Austin was where we came up from Houston to kind of hang out. So we've been around Texas since the late 80s. And we definitely consider Austin home.
Yeah. And tell our listeners too, just maybe a little bit to get to know you, family here. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, my, all three of my kids went to school here and, you know, graduated high school here. Unfortunately, only one of them still lives here. The other two are on the East Coast, but, we've been, you know, pretty well, entrenched in Austin, as I said, since 94. We have some extended family here, but really the thing about Austin that's been interesting is we've built really deep networks of friends and very deep relationships. And as Austin's grown, you know, we've considered, especially now that I have an academic career, we've considered, you know, maybe it's time to go find another city. But the reality is even though Austin's grown, the connections have just gotten deeper and broader. They haven't gotten thinner, you know, which is what I'd experienced in other cities. So, you know, we feel pretty connected to the Austin community.
Well, picking up on that theme of how the Austin landscape has changed over the years, one of the more significant players in town is Capital Factory, which has developed really an international reputation for building entrepreneur capabilities. And you are a mentor at the factory. And I'm curious, just picking up on the thread also of first-time leadership and early traps, for those individuals who are just starting to grow their companies and nurse them along within the Capital Factory setting, what are the early leader traps that you see among those first-time entrepreneurs?
I think a trap that I see frequently is trying to make connections to get a specific answer or outcome instead of developing the deeper relationships and the deeper connections, and then figuring out who in the network is the right person to talk to. And I'm going to give you a couple pieces that I've learned and seen through this. One is, and one of the things, this is something I got through my PhD program when we were talking about academia, and the light bulb went off and I said, oh, this is exactly what we deal with in a Capital Factory. And the message was, you know, if you're going to get into a domain or a discipline, there's a conversation in the research world that's going on. And, you know, it's just like if you were to walk into somebody's conversation and just start contributing and have no idea what the conversation was before you came in or even what they're talking about and expect that you're going to be accepted. And the same thing happens at Capital Factory. If you just come into the Capital Factory or into a new environment with a new startup and you just start engaging and you don't spend the time to understand the conversations, understand who the players are, figure out what their needs and wants are, what you're going to do is you're going to alienate a lot of that community. It's much better to spend time developing the deeper relationships, finding out where those people meet, you know, meet up. What are the important things to be reading? Who are the important people to know? And try to build those connections and then decide which of those relationships may be able to help you achieve certain things. And people don't like to be used, you know, and I think if you go at it with, can you make an introduction to the right person who's going to help me fix this problem or answer this question? It doesn't go very far. You may get those introductions, but I almost guarantee the introductions to the person you're being introduced to will come with the caveat of, hey, you know, just new person coming in, you know, be nice, which is, it's not really how you want to enter those. So I would say understanding that these are conversations and trying to understand those players and what the conversations are is really important.
I can say from personal experience, that's very true.
Yeah.
Yep.
In fact, did you have a purposeful mentor relationship when you founded your first company, Motion Computing? Purposeful in that you sought that individual out, or was it accidental or imposed upon you?
You know, it's a great question, Dave, because I spent a lot of time thinking about this. And, you know, you personally know my history, and I have mentors from the beginning of my career that I'm still in contact with today. My first board member for Motion Computing was Ed Esber, the chairman and CEO of my first tech job in the early 80s in Los Angeles, who, when I was starting the company, agreed to come in and be my first outside board member. Former chairman CEO of Creative Labs, of Ashton Tate. And what I realize now looking back was, part of this is maybe because early on in my career I was a pleaser, but I went to people that I respected and worked for them or tried to find ways to help them so that I could actually learn from them. And I think I became later in my career much more thoughtful about how I did that. But I really realized, and I've seen this today with people that I mentor, and I still have mentors. I have academic mentors now. I have a couple of them that laugh at me because they're younger than me. And I go to them all the time for advice. But, you know, I always think about how can I add value to them before I ask how they're going to add value to me. And a lot of times it's not the questions that I ask and they answer. It's the observing them and being around them. Again, think about the conversations, being invited by them to join at events. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the things that I did when I applied for the PhD program was I heard early on that there were academic conferences and we were encouraged to go to the academic conferences. And for 3 years, I went to two major academic conferences for management, which is where entrepreneurship is, and two for marketing, because I wasn't sure early on whether I was going to go for a PhD in marketing or in entrepreneurship. And I had a mentor in each of those disciplines, and they both took me to the conferences with them the first year. And because I was a student and I was with them, they invited me to go to their meetings, and they invited me to sit in some of their sessions that they were either judging papers or they were moderating a panel. And of course, my payoff was I buy them a beer afterwards, or I take them to dinner and thank them. I mean, I always thought about what I could give back. But the contacts I made because they let me tag along became great friends and mentors and really has helped me in my career. So I just got, it was announced 2 weeks ago that I received tenure at the university. The end of my 6th year, I'm starting my 7th year, the first point I can get it. And I guarantee you it's because of those relationships and the contacts I made through my mentor, not because my mentor actually answered my questions or told me what to do, but because they let me participate with them in the conversations they were having. And over time, I've taken those conversations in my own direction and built those relationships. So probably a longer answer than you wanted, but that's what I learned from the mentor side.
Now that's great. I appreciate you sharing that perspective. I mean, from where I sit, and you seem to reinforce it, mentors often believe in us more than we believe in ourselves at times. Thus, they create those milestone moments, such as you described, in which you were introduced to a number of people who made a difference in your life that the mentor relationship created. So
that's true. Well, the other thing that you, I think people have to think about is that mentors aren't going to bring you around if they don't think you're worth bringing around. You know, I'm not going to take a mentee with me if I think the person's not going to add value or the person's going to, you know, heaven forbid, embarrass me. So I think, you know, also realizing that you represent that mentor when you those things happen is very important, being cognizant. And I think you're right, you know, from a self-worth standpoint, you know, mentors can actually do a lot to reinforce, you know, your personal perceived value. But I would say it's not because they pat your back. It's because they provide you the opportunities to show yourself and excel. And I would say if you're expecting your mentor to do that, you're expecting the wrong thing from your mentor.
So let's move. Sorry, Chris, you were going to offer something.
Well, yeah, I was just going to, I want to ask a little bit about some of the early on in your career, right? And founding Motion Computing and kind of taking that a step further. If you think about the mentoring maybe you didn't receive or the, what happened during those processes when you didn't really listen to the advisors or their advice, what traps did you fall into early on when the stakes were high?
Yeah, I think the biggest trap I ran into early on, and I think you picked the right spot because Motion was a very different thing for me. So I had always been at companies that were big. They may have been small when I started there, like Compaq was not that big when I started, but it grew. But you know, it was a big enough company that I was just a part of a team. And when I went to start Motion, it was all brand new. And I wasn't sure who to really listen to. So I sought out a lot of people. And I think the early mistake I made was that the last advice I got was the advice I took, or the title of the person that was giving me the advice would trump the title of somebody else. And so that's who I listened to. And I fell into that trap quite a bit early on. And then I realized, you know, I had learned about triangulation in the service when I was doing navigating. And I said, you know, look, if you take only one point when you're doing navigating, dead reckoning, you're probably not on course, but at least you get an idea. If you take two, you may be a little bit closer, but there's a good chance because where those 2 points over, overlap could be pretty far off still. But if you start getting three or more and they say the same location, you're pretty close to location. And I use that triangulation approach with my mentors. So instead of acting on the first thing early on that I've been doing, I learned to collect, to find which one I thought was interesting, and then look for more validating feedback from other people. And when I had enough data points, that's when I made the decision. But early on, I'm sure that our founding team were like pulling their hair out because it was like ping, 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 you know, whoever I talked to last, because I really was so uncertain about the startup world. That's who we listened to early on. And so I think that was probably a big trap I fell into. And I still see founders doing that. Happens a lot at Capital Factory. You know, and founders will get mad and founders will say, well, the person I just talked to an hour ago gave me exactly the opposite input. I said, I would say that's great. That's two data points. Go get another three or four data points, whichever one has the highest and, you know, the best level of experience behind those ideas. That's the one you probably ought to take. Yeah. Because you're never going to get 100%. This is the right answer.
Yeah, it's almost a running joke in a lot of the larger corporations I've run into that a lot of the employees circling the leader kind of know, like, okay, who gets to him or her last? That's going to be the decision that they make. So everybody kind of jockeys to know who gets in that last piece of advice, and that's often the direction they take.
Yep, I've been in that situation.
So let's play a bit, if I may, with you now entering into the role of growing an early stage company. You've started at Motion Computing. It's a brand. You have a product. And now you need to build the company. So talk a bit about those early hires, the first five employees. What are the traps you can fall into as a first-time entrepreneur? You've hardly been generating revenue, if at all. You may be working off of some sort of seed investment, or you're self-funding the company. What are the early mistakes that can potentially be made with those first hires?
Well, so probably the biggest one, and I'm hesitating because it's such a big topic. I'm trying to figure out how to dive into this. This is one of those that I look back and I go, oh my God, I was so lucky of how how we pulled the first team together. And it was, I think the trap that I see most founders make is they tend to try to hire people that they can manage to get the job done, which is not what I did at Motion. What I did at Motion, it was totally by accident, was I knew what I wanted to build and I knew who had retired from Dell. And I looked for people that had the functional skills that I needed to build the product I want, or, you know, help me build the company. And the fact that most of them were either above my level or two above my level or right at my level was not really intimidating to me because I knew everybody was retired. So my first, you know, there were eight of us in the first group. I got, you know, seven friends. So all of us got in the room. And of the seven, everybody except for two were a level above me, equal to me or a level above me, and in different disciplines. There were only two people on that team that we brought together in that first time that had worked for me before or worked for a peer of mine or somebody I knew that were in the career stack a little bit lower. As a matter of fact, the person became co-chairman with me in that first group was my boss's boss's boss. And because they were so senior, I never would have thought of trying to tell them what to do. I would say, here's the problem we have, what do we do? And they would do that. So what I tell people, and now that I've mentored a lot of startups, I see this difference in these teams. You'll find the startups where the founder is smart enough to hire people that they would work for, versus founders that hire people they think that they can manage to do what they want them to do. And the founders that actually hire people that they're willing to work for are the ones that actually I find get the most done or the most successful, because rarely do they ever get, I can't recall a single case of a founder I know that has gotten thrown out by somebody that brought in that had more skills. It kind of is the, you know, it floats all boats kind of a thing. It raises the whole organization. And, you know, when we did Motion, we started, you know, the original team wanted me to be the CEO. And I just didn't feel ready. I didn't feel like I had the skill or the capability. In that case, it wasn't that I didn't want it. It was that I just didn't feel I was the right person. But
you
those
seem
people,
to carry that perspective of, hey, I don't want to be your CEO throughout your lifetime with Motion, the number of years you were there.
Yeah, I love being number two. I like being, and I've told people most of my executive career, my favorite thing is being number two. I tell people the Charlie Munger to Warren Buffett. I love to be that. Matter of fact, person I was number two, the two people at Dell I was number two to was this guy, John Medica, who had come from Apple to start Notebooks, yeah. Well known in the industry. He brought me in from Motorola. And I was his number two for a while, running worldwide marketing, probably the most fun I ever had in my career. And the second one was Jeff Clark, who's now the vice chairman of Dell. He and I started workstations together. I was over in Europe, starting the Europe division, and he ran product group. And when I came back to the United States, I went to work for him as his number two. And you know, I'm sure there's probably three or four people that think they were also his number two, but I know what my role was. And even here, when I went into higher ed, when they asked me to come help in the dean's office, I was happy to be number two. It's a great job. It's, you know, it's organizing and managing and getting the team to function at high skill and high productivity is really fun. Building an excited workforce and a productive workforce, that's what I really love to do. And it doesn't mean that I don't have a role in strategy, because you do play a role, but I don't feel like, to me, the fun isn't laying out the strategy. To me, the fun is executing and beating the plan. That's what I like to do. And I know there's quite a few people in that, you know, that like to be that level of person. So, you know, that's where I am. But my point of this back on the early side about the early people is, you know, if you do a good job of hiring people that you would be willing to work for in the future, you really don't have to worry about them taking your job. They are going to make your job easier and they're going to lift you up. And I think that's a trap a lot of leaders. Leaders seem to think that they have to know everything. They have to be the ones that are always right. And my favorite thing isn't coming up with the answer. It used to be when I was younger, I thought that's how you got ahead. It isn't. The trick of being a leader is finding out the right questions that need to be answered and getting the right people to answer them faster than the competition can answer them. And that's what I love to do. And that's, you know, that's why it's really hard to do that if you're hiring people that are just waiting for you to give them a command.
You know, I've observed over the years from just coaching different leaders that I've come to see is when I see a leader who thinks they need to know everything, and to me, it's often a red flag that they're a bit of an imposter and mm-hmm. they're just scared to death to admit they don't know something, and everybody would think that they're really not in control. And it's really quite the opposite. It's the leaders who ask questions because they've hired those people around them that they count on them to know the incredible detail that they have to manage. And those are the ones that to me are more in control.
Yeah, I don't know. Are we allowed to use people's names in this podcast?
Really up to you.
Yeah, hey, it's your time.
I'll give you an example. Mark McLean of SailPoint is an excellent example. Mark, you know, I've been on his board. He was chairman of Austin Technology Council. I've spent time with him interviewing him for panels we've been on. I've just spent a lot of time seeing Mark interact. And he's a great example of exactly what you just said, Chris. We would be wrestling with a tough problem at Austin Technology Council. And people say, Mark, what would you want to do here? And Mark would ask five questions. You know, he just start spinning, you know, well, what do you think about this? What's the biggest problem we have to face? You know, and Mark's a great example, very self-effacing. If you say, because, you know, he won a big award for like best CEO or something. And I said, you know, oh, congratulations, this is awesome. And he was so embarrassed by it. And I think that's a sign of a great CEO. He's, you know, he gives all the credit to his people. You know, he marks the epitome of that. He is the, what we like to, you know, we use the term loosely, but I think he's a great example of a servant leader. No he question. Views his job about as raising everybody up.
I've seen him in action. He's his company, SailPoint, has been a client of mine, and I conducted a number of leadership training programs. He tried to set in on virtually all of those. And at the end of the session, as everyone's walking out, who is setting the tables back up and the chairs back in place? Mark McClain, the CEO of this very successful company. Such a humble guy. And that modeled behavior permeated the organization. They would follow her backwards to do his work. Good guy.
You're right. I mean, there's people like that. Mark McClain, Gene Austin, both of those guys were role models for me. Mm-hmm. I'd love to have been able to spend more time to really say they were truly mentors, but they were definitely role mentors. And there's a role models. I mean, and there's a few role models in town like that, but that servant leadership, and you look at both of those guys and they've hired really good people. That's one thing. One other thing I would say that, Dave, you and I have seen, we've had this conversation in the past. Look at who follows leaders to their new place. There are so many times, if you hire a new C-level executive and they don't have a ready stable of really good people that want to follow them, it's a pretty good sign there's a problem.
That's an indicator. Question about it. In fact, we've been talking about your prior experience before founding a company. Have you developed a point of view as you mentor first-time entrepreneurs that they should have a fair amount of background, that there's an advantage to having big company, small company experience, so they have those frameworks to draw from? Or do you not view that or take it on a case-by-case basis with leaders you meet?
It's a case-by-case basis, but I would say, first of all, I am not a fan of this push to encourage students to drop out of college or, you know, just start a company right out of school. Because the reality is domain expertise or domain experience is really important. And new businesses fail at a really hard rate, at a really high rate. So to tell somebody it's never worked in anything, you know, I've never cut lawns before, but I'm going to start a company to do lawn cutting, and I know I'm going to be successful against people that have been lawn cutting a long time, is pretty tough. It's not impossible. It can be done, but it's tough. So I am much more positive on people that have had some domain expertise, or again, not expertise, wrong word, domain experience. If somebody worked in a food industry for 2 or 3 years and said, you know what, I've done this and I have an idea for how we could do it better and we can create a new product, I have a lot more faith in them. Whether or not they've worked for a big company or a small company, as long as they have the domain expertise. But one of the things that people forget is that entrepreneurship and new ventures are a heavily risky enterprise. There is all kinds of risks. There's product market fit, there's financial risk, there's regulatory risk, there's human resource risk, there's operations risk. You know, you can go down this whole line. And really good entrepreneurs manage risk very, very aggressively and efficiently. They understand how to identify where their risk points are, and they put the plans in place to minimize their exposure to that risk while they invest in building the business. And it's hard to see how somebody that has never worked or has never had domain expertise knows how to do all that. You can do that with good mentorship, and you can do it with good leaders. It's just harder. And there's, you know, great examples. Sergey and Larry, Sergey Brin and Larry at Google is a great example. They brought in Eric Schmidt, old hand from, you know, 3Com. If you go look at Facebook, he brought in Mark Zuckerberg, brought in old hands from the VC firm that helped guide him and grow him. Michael Dell brought in, you know, experienced people. He ran that company for quite a while with what they called three in the box. It was an office of the CEO with three people. So it can be done, but it takes a lot more work. When someone says, oh, you know, my son's a sophomore in college, he's got a great idea for a new computer company. And I know you did that. Will you help him, you know, give him some advice? And my advice is stay in school and finish it up. Go work for a computer company for a couple of years, then do it. And it's not always popular because there's a lot of people who go, oh no, you know, time is money and you need to go.
You'll miss your window.
But you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. It's execution that wins.
That's true. Yeah. I'm curious because you've had a chance to see corporate world and academia, right? And you've got a lot of great wisdom to share, and both you've actually experienced what it's like to build a business. What made you want to make that switch from the corporate world to academia? They're totally different environments, different pace. I think our listeners would love to know why the switch.
Well, you know, I started as an adjunct professor teaching a class or two a semester in the afternoons when I was back at Motion as CEO. And I was not ever really interested in it. I had gone back and did my MBA, graduated from there in 2007. I had been on the advisory board for the business school. Right after I graduated, the dean said, hey, we have a marketing class. Do you want to teach? I'm like, I don't have a PhD. She said, no, we need an adjunct. You have a master's. That's good enough. I said, well, I just got out of school. I like being around campus, so I'll do one. And I fell in love with it. And by my fourth year, probably between my third and fourth year of my CEO gig, I was like, you know, I don't really want to go start another company from scratch and go through this. I really don't want to go back to a big company like Dell. Best part of my day is when I am in the classroom with these students. So I spoke to the dean and I said, you know, I think when I'm done, I may, you know, do another year at Motion. I'd love to come teach full time. And she said, fantastic, go get your PhD. I'm like, I'm not going to get it. She goes, well, you'll never get hired. If you really want to be, you can be an adjunct, you know, as long as you want. But if you want to be a real professor, you need to go get your PhD. And that's when I started talking to David about it and saying, hey, I got this, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? You think I should do this? Am I crazy? But, you know, for me.
And I should tell you, if I can just step in for one quick second, because I do clearly recall I was torn. You were a popular CEO. People were drawn to you. You were charismatic. People often join companies, but they stay because of leadership. And yet at the same time, you were kind enough to bring me into your conference and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking of doing. And my selfish inner response is, you know what? No, don't do that because you're going to screw up this good thing we've got going here with these employees. And but yeah, I wanted to support you as a friend too. And I knew this was something you had a passion for.
Yeah. And frankly, at the time, and I wasn't probably as clear about what it was when it was happening, but at the time, the company was kind of in a just turn the crank quarter to quarter, same thing, eking out a little bit of profit every quarter, trying to get, you know, the board to let us do something to raise more capital to do something else. And it was another rock fetching, and we'd make the quarter and it'd be like, okay, here we go again, you know, another quarter. That was the first part. The second part is I really enjoy the execution and the growing and, you know, getting people and passion and building something. And it wasn't at that point anymore. It was a, you know, turn the crank kind of business. And it just wasn't exciting to me. And when I was around the students, what I was realizing was I was learning stuff all the time. And I was watching them get excited. And it was getting me excited. And so I thought, you know, if I could figure out how to do this. And then when I went into the PhD program and I realized, oh, this is entrepreneurship for knowledge. I'm discovering new things, getting people excited about a topic on a regular basis, and I get paid for it. This is awesome. That's what really switched me over. But, you know, at the time Dave and I were talking, I mean, I think he said it well, the board was not happy with me that I was, first of all, that I wasn't happy. They were trying to figure out why I wasn't happy, but it wasn't what was floating my boat anymore. And you know, there are days when I would drive in the parking lot and I would sit in my car for 20 minutes to psych myself to go in because I had to be up for the employees, but I just wasn't excited about it anymore.
Didn't it take a physical toll on you too?
If you remember, I got really, really, really sick. And, what I did was, is I tried all these different things to try to, you know, make myself feel better. I started, you know, doing these massively long century bike rides. We had a team, if you remember, at the company that we would all go do bike riding. I was playing basketball and with the employees. And actually, I got something that happened to me through the bike riding that turned into about a year long illness. And it took a huge toll on me physically, mentally. I was not in a good place, which was funny because everybody thought it was going great. And everybody said, you know, you look super, you know, keep going. How could you leave us? And I was like, well, you know, if I don't leave, I'm not going to be in a good place. So, you know, and that was where, and the benefit of all this is, and the fun part is I haven't had to give up the business stuff. You know, I mentor companies. I'm active at Capital Factory. I've invested. I get to help and play. And I get to do the research and I get to work with young people. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of saying that you should just do what you're passionate about, because sometimes things you're passionate about don't pay really well. But if you're able to do something that you can get paid well and you really enjoy doing it, man, that's a blessing. And for, you know, probably 7 years of Motion, that was what it was for me, because we were just continuing to build and grow. And then it just got to the point where it was, you know, just not what I was really excited about.
All right. So this is a great segue into our segment that we like to do with all of our guests, just to have a little bit of fun in the middle of our podcast here. And our segment for you is called Famous College Deans. I'm going to give you multiple choice here, three options of which dean was popular in this particular movie. So I'll name the movie, you pick out the dean. You ready? Okay. All right. Here's the first one. Who was the dean in Ferris Bueller? Was it A, Dean Richmond? Was it B, Dean Rooney? Or was it C, Dean Ulick?
It was A, Dean Richmond.
No, it was Dean Rooney, who chased him all through the neighborhood. He had such great leadership skills.
Oh, that's right. I remember Dean Rooney now.
Yeah, okay. Dean Rooney. Yeah, that's right. Remember, he got slipped into the mud there for a while and made his way back. Yeah, famous. All right, here's the next one. Who was the famous dean in Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield? Was it A, Chancellor Sarah Gaskell, Dean Marcus Brody, or Dr. Philip Barber?
So in this one, I remember the movie because I think it was Rodney Dangerfield. And I remember he got involved with one of the people, but I don't remember whether it was a teacher or principal. I think it was Philip Barber. I think it was the guy.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Marcus Brody, for extra bonus points, do you know?
No clue.
Yeah, that was Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay. And then, and then Sarah Gaskell was from Wonder Boys. All right. My last one, and if you don't get this one, we're cutting the podcast short. Who was the dean in Animal House? Was it A, Dean Koontz? Was it B, Dean Wormer? Or was it C, Dean Yeager?
It was Dean Wormer. Who could forget Dean Wormer?
That was a layup.
That was the easiest one of all. Thank you. I needed that one.
There you go. We wanted to finish that segment in style for you.
You know, I didn't pay attention to deans until I became an associate dean. So you're lucky I even knew any of them.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
I want to circle back to our discussion about prior experience. Oftentimes, giving a perspective to an entrepreneur that they otherwise wouldn't be able to draw on. However, I want to play with it a little bit when it comes to Dell. So Dell, as a company, was known as having this nasty reputation of being brutish as a culture and calling people out publicly. I used to work for a company years ago. We're talking about the 90s. And we used to say, well, it may be bad here, but we're certainly not Dell, even though Dell was highly successful as a company. I'm wondering if you experienced that, and if you did it influence you to say, I'm not taking those cultural elements into my next company experience when I'm leading? What's your take on that culture or that broader experience you may have witnessed?
Well, I went to Dell in early 94. And I think at the time I went in, which, you know, is really kind of an interesting time because, you know, John Medica, the person I talked about earlier who brought me, his first thing he did was he terminated the notebook business line and started from scratch. Dell had been growing and growing and kind of hit a tough spot. So I came right in the middle of that tough spot. And it was a very aggressive place. But I think so my experience there, I loved my Dell experience. I will go on the record as saying it was the best MBA I ever had. Dell, and I've talked to friends that are still there who say some of the great pieces of their culture are still, you know, as vibrant now that they're, I don't know, what, 150,000 people as it was when we had 2,000 or 3,000 people. The thing that was great about Dell was as much as you wanted to take on, they were willing to let you try it. You know, if you were somebody to put your hand up and said, I've never done that, but I want to do it. You almost always got the shot. And you look at my career there at Dell, I started there for, you know, as the head of worldwide marketing and the product group for notebooks. They sent me over to Europe, because they needed me to be the GM of the notebook division. They were trying to grow the notebooks there. Then they said, hey, do you want to help start the workstation division? Go set up the factory, go help hire the people in the country. I'd never done any of that before. And it was a place, as long as you said, yeah, I'll try. You know, and if you failed, you didn't necessarily get thrown out. You may get put back in your job and go in the penalty box for a little bit. But you were really rewarded for taking that effort on. The problem with Dell is not everybody had that attitude. And I never had executives. Michael, I never had Michael Dell or Kevin Rollins or Mort Toffer ever really yell at me. And, you know, I've told Dave about a situation with Michael Dell. One time he yelled at me in a Michael way, which was in the middle of an executive review. Very quietly, he said, David, clearly you're not hearing me. And everybody in the executive team went, ooh, and that's how I knew. But what did happen was you had people like me that were really trying to work hard and get things done, that if you weren't working just as hard, we were not going to make your life easy. Because we were all hard charging. And if you weren't hard charging, we didn't have room for you. And so I would say it was more the peer set that made the Dell hell experience. And there were some managers that were pretty tough. I mean, it was an aggressive place. But I mean, I'm not a hard, you know, aggressive person. And I loved my time there. I learned a lot. I didn't, you know, sometimes you get tired of the challenges, you know, it's tough. But what I did learn from there that I took with me and I still take with me is you want a team that drives the team. If as a manager, you have to push people to do the work, you're going to have a hard time. But if you have enough people on the team and you're hiring junior people that are aggressive and will work hard and will drive the others, it will push, again, everything back up. So, yeah, and I will tell you, Dave, and you've seen this with me. I'll tell you the one lesson I didn't learn from there that I should have, that I've really thought a lot about over the last few years, is Dell was very good that if it wasn't a fit, they moved you out quickly. And I didn't do that. I even at Motion, if I really liked a person and believed in a person, I was one of those persons, well, let's just invest a little more time. Let's try a little more. And what ended up happening a lot of times was it brought the organization down. Because the organizations, especially in smaller startups, tend to kind of drop down to the capabilities of the lowest, you know,
yeah,
lifter.
The weaker links, yeah.
The weaker, I don't like to use that word, but you're right, the weaker links. It's the, you know, and that was not that way at Dell. So because Dell was that way, Dell was a very aggressive, you know, you've got to be, you know, you've got to produce or go. It had that reputation, but I never had the experience my entire time there. I mean, David and I have talked on the side. Yeah, I've been in meetings where people threw erasers and threw pens, but it usually wasn't one-sided. There were multiple people doing it because people were really ramped up about what we were trying to do. And so, you know, I thought that was pretty good. I also think it depends on where you were, where it doesn't matter what company you're at. It depends on where you are in the organization. You know, Motorola was a top 10 employer when I was there in the early 90s.
And, highly regarded.
Highly regarded. But depending on where you were in the organization, you know, you could be in one sector where it was a really great place to work and another sector where it was a horrible place to work. Because the bigger the organization is, the more you're going to have, you know, managers that have different skill sets. But yeah, my experience was, I thank God for the opportunity to work at Dell and work around those people every day. The lessons I learned.
One thing I've observed from seeing that as organizations start to grow is that you might have a culture that starts out where a set of core values that you talk about, right? As you described Dell, there was a set of values and high expectations, and you know, if other people didn't hold their weight, we didn't hang around. But as organizations grow, if the values don't carry through, I think what you get are people that start mimicking those behaviors, and then it becomes more of a caricature. And then that caricature then that starts to instill the bad part of what we see in some of these big companies, where then, oh, they're just being a jerk, but they're really just trying to mimic what they saw in somebody else who was really just being tough.
I agree with that, Chris. You just triggered it when you said that. I think one of the other leadership traps is you set those core cultures, and if you aren't managing them as a leader throughout your organization all the time, the telephone game happens. And those mimickers rewrite those core values in a way that's self-serving for them. I'll give you a great example. When I went to Compaq in the 80s, you know, Compaq was, again, not that big of a company. It was growing like crazy. It was about consensus management. And consensus management was a Rod Canyon thing. It didn't mean at the time that everybody got a vote. It meant that everybody had input. There was still a decider. By the time I left, consensus management had been reconfigured by middle managers to be, I can stop anything because I don't agree. And I think one of the problems that the senior leadership did was they didn't go back in and recalibrate and say, that's not what consensus management is. And they let that go too far. And what happened was products got developed that were team developed instead of being developed by the architects or whatever. This is my impression of being there. We just lost our edge. Because we were trying to get everybody to vote for the right product. We saw this at Dell too. I mean, at Motion too, where we got to that point. There was a period where I left to go back to school. The CEO we had when we started, that I brought on to run the company, really wanted much more of a consensus than I had had. I had the old Compaq version of consensus. Which was everybody gets a say, but at the end of the day, I'll be the decider if we don't get everybody to agree. Matter of fact, I would say to people, I'd say to our leaders, I'd say, look, if you guys have a disagreement, you go work it out with each other. If you can't work it out, then come to me, and I promise you I will make a decision. Whether or not one of you like it or not will be different. So you're better off figuring it out yourself. But what happened when I was gone was it became much more of the traditional, you know, the later stage consensus where anybody could stop. And what ended up happening was there were compromises made on features, on components, on policies. And when I went back in there, you know, there are things that we did to go back to, okay, we need, you know, decisions were taken forever to be done. We had a thing called the PDP, the product development docs. Product development plan, that we weren't supposed to do products until they got signed off. Had products were coming out of the factory that they were never signed off because they could never get agreement. And that to me is an example of, you have core values, the leaders have to reinforce them, but you got to be a leader. You've got to be willing to say, okay, you get 10 more minutes. If you can't make the decision, come see me. I'm going to decide and you're all going to live with it. And those are the kind of things that I see a big trap that leaders get into, whether it's a small company or a big company. I see it in the universities too. You know, see it with chairs. Yeah. They want everybody to be happy, and they confuse happiness with everybody gets a vote. And actually happiness is everybody gets a say and a decision is made, because it's worse to not have a decision than have a decision that people got input in, but they don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah. I think leaders underestimate how subtle those changes are. And I would say I don't know if I can name one leader that I would say was exceptional at recognizing it and swiftly stepping in and addressing it. We just don't do it till it's too late and they start to see revenue fall and things start to turn.
Well, and I think one of the reasons that happens is that something that's really bizarre that happens when you become a leader of an organization is there's a level that gets, you know, that gets created just naturally underneath you of people that you turn to get insights. and you start to lose vision below the waterline. And I noticed that when I came back, and Dave can attest to this. One of the things that I did to try to get through that was, I'm a terrible athlete, but I started playing basketball 2 days a week on the back deck with the employees. And it was, we had test engineers, we had sales support people, we had developers. And the rule was, when I was on the court, you could hack me all you wanted. There was no titles. I learned more about what was really going on in the company from the basketball games than I did from the executive meetings. Because people would talk. They wouldn't be talking to me. They'd be talking to each other. They'd be complaining about this decision, complaining about that direction. I was like, oh, okay, well, now I know what's really going on. So I think leaders have to find out how they dig down and get organically what's going on. And I would say one of the problems is, a lot of them say, well, I'm going to do a brown bag lunch with my employees. I've done this at the university. What I find is, I don't get the same kind of information from a brown bag lunch that I do when I'm playing basketball.
Yeah. The brown bag lunch is a bit too staged.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. Upon reflection, Dave, would you have done anything different or more purposeful when you were growing your leadership team to make it more diverse in every way?
Boy, that's a great question, David. Well, I think if you look at our team, we had, in the early days, it wasn't as diverse because even though it was not all men, it was mostly men. But in the later stages of the company, we had a really good mix of...
There was a gender mix, exactly, for sure.
Yeah, there was gender mix for sure. I think the diversity mix is something, yeah, I would have liked to have done a better job at. I think, when you're in the entrepreneur, when you are in the kind of growth that we were going through, and you're a small company, you're kind of at the mercy of the resources available to you locally. It's a cop-out to a certain extent, but it's also true. You know, where at Dell, I could actually recruit for that, and I could afford to relocate people and bring in that kind of talent. When you're a small company, I had to get the talent that I needed for that role on the, basically, just be fair, on the cheap, as that tends to be, can't pay relo. Can't pay, anything like that.
I think you and I talked about how the early stage hires are the believers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're hiring believers because they are taking a leap of faith along with you. And they're going to trade off some of the things that you mentioned, earnings and possibly opportunities at more established companies.
So I think that's perfect that you brought that up. Let's talk about the one debate that I knew that you played a role in, that John, our head of engineering, and I had for the first 3 or 4 years. My policy, one of the first things I was proud of, was we created a employment table. I don't remember what you call it. A job grade salary table.
Oh, yeah.
We had it for technical and non-technical. So we had the ladder. We had it all set up. But my rule was, when we figured out what were the industry standards, we weren't going to pay over 75% of the mid-level. So it was mid-level. You could do between 50 to 75% of the normal salary.
Oh my gosh, it all comes roaring back now.
You and I would have big battles about it. And John would get furious. And I go, look, I want people who believe in the mission and believe in the value of the stock and believe in what we're doing. I don't want people that are just going to come in and work for 8 hours and leave. And honestly, for the first 4 years, probably, the company, that worked great. It worked great until we hit the point where we had to hire talent that wasn't willing to do that. And to me, that was when, my view is, that's when the Pandora's box opened and all the talent that had been hired the past 4 years wanted a make good. But everybody else, and I know Dave will say, well, no, you should have done that in the beginning. But I truly believe that if we had not done that, we would not have had the talent. First of all, we wouldn't have had the talent we had. Second of all, we wouldn't have been able to have the breadth of coverage we needed because we didn't have the cash for it, Yeah. And I could only get people to volunteer their time for so much.
Yeah. And they're in it with you, right? They're co-owners of the company. So you traded ownership and equity for cash. And that's a known condition. Sometimes entrepreneurial leaders can take that too far. They'll start trading off titles as well. We've talked about that in other segments with other guests, that, you know, if you come too title heavy and too equity heavy, then that skew gets a bit tough to correct as the company matures, if you're fortunate enough for the company to scale and mature.
Well, hey, let me just say this. The other thing that went with it, because it was not just a dollar thing alone. There was something somebody, and I wish I remember who the mentor was that told me, but somebody said this to me early in my career, and I took it to heart, and I've really executed on this, and I really believe it. I would tell people, if you come work for me, one of three things is going to happen. Either you're going to do really well working for me because you're going to get the opportunity to learn, and I'm going to promote you because I have an opportunity. Number two is I'm not going to have an opportunity because my group isn't growing, but you're going to learn. And one of the other organizations in our company is going to recognize how good you are because you're going to get the visibility and you're going to get an opportunity to get a better job in the organization somewhere else. Or three, neither of those two things are going to happen because the company just isn't growing, but you're going to get that visibility and that experience and you're going to be really valuable outside and you're going to get a better job. And I promise you, if you come work for me, one of those three things are going to happen. Either you're going to help us kick the heck out of this opportunity, and there's going to be headroom for you to be moved up, or you're going to kick the heck out of the opportunity. We're not going to grow as much as we thought, but someone's going to see you, and they're going to take you away. And I'm okay with any three of those, as long as you're willing to go put up and take this risk with me at that salary level. And I still use that even with faculty that we're bringing in. It's like, look, we'll give you the opportunity. We'll give you the exposure. One of those three things will happen, I promise.
I agree with that narrative too. I've used variations of that. I think that's well stated. Hey, before you get away from us, we like to pose a moral dilemma question to our guest. It's hopefully posed in such a way, if I've done my job, then you're going to struggle a bit with this because it represents trade-offs possibly in your own values, in your own sense of what's right and wrong, on what's important in the moment. So let's try this one, if we may. I had some questions. We got so many questions we're not going to get to. There was a series of questions about building a board of director relationships and so forth. And in that spirit, I want to pose a moral dilemma to you.
Okay.
Let's say you were squeezed for cash. You've experienced this as an entrepreneur. You're just hitting the end point of your burn rate, and you've got to get the next round of funding. And you've secured a critical, prominent investor who has deep pockets. And this investor has committed to you for the modest exchange of the board seat, which you were easily willing to trade off for that. You'll give them the board seat, that they will come in with $50 million, more than you would have even anticipated. This gives you so much breathing as a company. And at the same time, this incoming investor / board member says, I've eyeballed your team, and you need to get rid of your number two, which, by the way, happens to be one of your dearest friends, and you have a strong relationship with, and you believe in this person. This person has carried you along the way. In a sense, they're kind of a mentor to you as well. But the incoming investor says, you've got to get rid of that number two, your number two. What's your take on that?
You know, this probably, you may be surprised, but it's not as hard of a dilemma for me as you think.
Shoot, I didn't do my job.
No, I think, because I think this is real. And you know, we've had this kind of situation. We could talk about that in a second, but you know, I faced exactly this. And I think the most important thing to do is you have to think about, as the CEO or as the leader, the stakeholders. And you have to decide which of the stakeholders you have an obligation and a moral obligation to protect and service. And in this case, if, as you said, I'm near the bleeding edge and there's $50 million and it's
a lot of
there,
people's pay at stake.
I have customers, I have employees, I have suppliers, I have a number of people that my making a personal emotional decision for my number two would risk those stakeholders. I think that's a very simple decision for me. However, I think the trick is not what, it's how. And so I think how that would be done would be really important. And I would work really hard to negotiate with that investor of how we find a new opportunity for that number two, either in the company or outside the company, to make it less painful for that number two. And if need be, I'll tell you, for me personally, I would sacrifice some of my personal opportunity or interest, including salary if I needed to help that number two get a safe landing. Because I think I would personally have an obligation to my number two. But I think as a leader, I have a moral obligation to the major stakeholders, which are the employees, the customers, and the suppliers, and my other investors. That's really what would drive my decision. And again, how is as important or more important than the what. And, you know, so I'll talk about to a real situation. You know, when I came back to the company, we had to raise another round of funding. And one of the covenants, in the term sheet was they wanted us to reduce the headcount to get this round of funding below a certain number by the end of the year. And it was like December 10th. And I absolutely refused to lay off people at Christmas break, to the point that it got to exactly what you said, David. I had to make the decision of, you know, where am I? Where's my moral compass? And what it came down to was I said, you know what? If that's what you insist on doing, you need another CEO, because I'm not going to do it. I refuse to do that. I will step away from the company right now and let the board appoint somebody else to do that, because I won't do it. And the other board members and investors pushed on the later round ones, and they allowed us to move it to the first of the year. And we did it, you know, right after the first of the year, but we were not going to ruin people's holidays. And much more importantly, do it in a period where they couldn't even have a chance of finding an opportunity. And again, when we talk about the how, if you remember, we put a lot of work into making sure that we found an outsourcing firm. We used our contacts to try to get people jobs. And when we actually got the ability to hire back, we went to the people that weren't rehired. That was the first place we went to bring people back into the company. Matter of fact, we had a VP that gave me a rec for a job when we first opened back up hiring. And I said, what about the people on the list? He goes, oh, we have an opportunity here to up-level the position. And I said, the people that were here till the end were great people. We're going to hire back off the list. And he did. And honestly, that was probably the best emotional capital I could have invested in the company, because people really, that word got around and people appreciate it. So I think the moral dilemma you posed is real, but I think it's a very simple answer, which is you have to think about your role and the stakeholders you are morally obligated to, and determine whether you're making a decision on behalf of your moral obligation to the stakeholders or your personal obligation to an individual.
Yeah, that's a great anecdote also to wrap up on. There is a shining, glaring light on senior leadership, especially a CEO. Sometimes they need to be reminded by others, like their mentors or someone in my capacity who's looking at the human capital side of things. People watch you very closely. It is exhausting. You knew that because you have enough empathy within you that you would do the things that you just described. And people recognize that. And that's why they would bend over backwards to stick it out, because you brought a humanity and a sense of genuine interest in the livelihoods of people. And it's amazing. As a result of that, that's just not a nice do-good thing, but people will, they'll bring their creative best, right? They'll take risks. You get better ideas, right? Because they realize you're going to advocate for them, so they can make some mistakes and come in with their wild ass idea, because you're going to give them room to do that. So I've really come to respect you, Chris, and David. I respect Chris too, because I've seen you in action do just these sorts of things. You balance the hard needs of running the business with the interest of creating a human space for people to thrive in. So I applaud you for that.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate it. I think I've just been fortunate to have worked for really great leaders that that I was able to learn from and try to mimic.
Yeah. And now you're a tenured professor, so you can relax and you can throw this tenureship back in the face of others and say, listen, say whatever you want, but I'm tenured, buddy.
I'm no longer a pretend academic. I'm a real academic.
You have earned your stripes.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's right. Yeah. David, real pleasure having you on the show tonight. Real pleasure to get your lessons learned. And hopefully the listeners have learned quite a bit that they can take away as well.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity. This was really fun. And it's always great to spend time with David. I learned a lot from him as well. We don't give him enough credit, but he had to batter me around and educate me quite a bit early on in my career as a CEO. So I really appreciate being able to do this one.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening. Do you know a leader who could benefit from hearing about the Leadership Trap? Well, we hope you will share this podcast with them. And remember, give the podcast a 5-star rating. Every rating helps us reach more leaders. You can find us at theleadershiptrap.org. Okay, we'll see you next time. And until then, stay out of those traps.